Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
The essence of America, what really unites us, it is an idea that you can come from humble circumstances and you can do great things.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We are the free and unconquerable people of the United States of America.
I tell you what freedom is to me, no fear.
The story of America is one of people who have made their dreams come true by realizing that the time for action is always now.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. This hour, a new conversation in our series, What It Means to Be an American. I'm asking activists and poets, writers and musicians to reflect on that question. And today, Jossi Ross is giving us his perspective. He's an essayist, spoken word artist, and poet. He's a member of the Blackfeet Nation, and he says his storytelling skills come from a family that liked to drink coffee, blow smoke, and spill out a few tall tales. I opened our conversation by asking him about a phrase from Langston Hughes' powerful poem, Let America Be America Again. The phrase reads, "Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed," and I wondered what that said to Jossi.
If I'm reading the poem correctly, and I've read it a million times, the one thing that we can agree on is that at one time, America was aspirational. And those aspirations, you know, they might have been right or they might have been wrong. They might have been not fully inclusive, but they were aspirational. They were willing to consider evolution. And assuming that we've arrived at that place of American dream, that takes away the aspiration part. That says evolution is complete. And based upon both speakers or both voices in the poem, that wasn't the purpose of a dream. The dream was to consider and to continually grow and evolve and dream, like, oh, we can always get better, but we're doing this, but we can always get better. But women got the right to vote in 1919, but we can always get better. Mm-hmm. But the 13th Amendment removed slavery, but we can always get better. And so in my estimation, it's to not stop dreaming, to not stop striving and being critical of ourselves in order to continue to get better.
You just said the key word that I see in that poem, because as you point out, there's a second voice saying, but America never was that. And then the other voice comes back in to say, let it be that, but it never was that. And that's that ability, I think, of, and I wonder if we've lost this, but of Americans to be idealistic and be committed to the dream and still be willing to look at how far we miss it, right? We are not fulfilling that dream for so many Americans.
My dad, he fought in Vietnam, and my grandpa also fought in Vietnam. And there's a disproportionate amount of Native Americans who fought in Vietnam, and poor people in general. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a matter of empirical fact. And My grandpa had a completely different take than my dad on the war. My dad told me if there's ever a war, when I was a kid, if there's ever a draft, you're going to Canada. Mm-hmm. You know, he had no aspirations of a poor person fighting in a rich person's war, when it's largely because of capitalistic sensibilities and there's a few people who are benefiting disproportionately from that. And then there's a whole bunch of people who are getting hurt disproportionately from that. But my dad also considered himself a patriot. And I fast forward to today's debate about Colin Kaepernick and all the folks who are, you know, being critical of the Pledge of Allegiance, the national anthem at sporting events. And the way, being influenced by my father, I see those folks as patriots. James Baldwin said, you know, that he loved America dearly, and as a result, he reserved the right to always critique it. And I think that those two ends aren't, they're not mutually exclusive. In fact, I think if we consider ourselves to be true patriots, we will always say that America, we're going to hold America to a higher standard to be the America that the dreamers dreamed. And we have to, we have a responsibility. Otherwise, we're not holding it to its highest standard. And as a result, America will not be as great as it could be.
What do you think makes people so uncomfortable about what someone like Colin Kaepernick is doing?
Well, obviously, it's influenced by race. The fact that it's a black man who's doing that. It's a new spectacle. Not saying that black folks and brown folks and women and Muslims have not been involved with social critique, but to have this sort of platform and to do it in a way that's so public is really rarefied air. Obviously, we can point to, you know, people in our past, obviously the great Muhammad Ali, John Carlos, Tommy White, like, you know, there's people that absolutely took a stand and were willing to publicly do that. But it largely cost them their careers. Muhammad Ali was you know, he didn't box for 3 years. He missed the prime of his life in order to do that. And so when we see such public spectacles, especially from brown and black folks, we're all also used to seeing soon after martyrdom from brown and black folks. And we've gotten comfortable with martyrdom. Oh, man, that's going to cost them their career.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten really comfortable with that correlation. And when you see Colin Kaepernick do it.
Colin Kaepernick.
He's the San Francisco 49ers quarterback, and he's been refusing to stand for the national anthem.
Yet the team is still holding on to him as just a financial matter. They renegotiate. I'm a football nerd. So they renegotiated a contract this week, which allows him, I think, to be a free agent after this year. And it's not necessarily him being a martyr. That's a powerful thing. Moreover, the reaction in a platform where it's disproportionately black,
mm-hmm.
by far, not even close, the NFL. The thought is that economics is supposed to trump everything. And so this black boy is just supposed to shut up and get his paycheck.
That's something that I was thinking about as you were describing this, that there is this sense of a perception of entitlement, and you should just be grateful for the opportunities, right, that you've got, and look at you dissing those kinds of opportunities. I don't know how conscious that is, but I do think there's an element of that in the censure around what he's doing. What's your thought?
Yeah, definitely. And I don't even think it's necessarily, I agree with you that I don't think it has to be conscious. There's a point, you know, as a person who, you know, has to work for a living, you know, in making not millions of dollars, I'm sure there's a part of me that resents these young men from, you know, for getting millions and millions of dollars for playing a game. But when you compound that with an already existent, you know, racial bias, racism, white supremacy, whatever you want to call it, you combine that with that resentment that I think is quite natural. Man, these guys make a lot of money. They have an amazing platform. They're people are vying for their attention, and the vast majority of us never had that experience. But when you, and I think that's true irrespective of who the audience is. But then when you combine that with racial, you know, animus, with racism, with white supremacy, it gets ugly. And that kind of, you know, perfect storm of circumstances says, man, you know, we are going to judge you by a different standard. We are going to say that, you know, this disproportionately African-American field, sports, basketball, football, you folks have no voice. You're simply a source of labor. Your job is to go out there and entertain us. And I think that harkens back to a much, much antiquated ideal where Black folks, and it was other people as well, obviously, but because these fields are so completely dominated by African-Americans, that those Black folks that are in those fields are not, you know, they're just supposed to play the, you know, very, very happy to be here, aw shucks guy that they saw with Jackie Robinson. Well, why can't you be like him? You know, Jackie Robinson was the reason why Branch Rickey got him was because he wouldn't fight, because he didn't speak up. And that's not a slight in any way to Jackie Robinson, because it was a completely different time. But that's the reason why he was recruited to cross that color barrier. And I think, you know, in this age of Make America Great Again, which is, you know, interesting analog to the poem Let America Be America Again.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. It viscerally, you would think it would say largely the same thing. And obviously it doesn't. But, you know, there's a definite sense of white nostalgia in 2016 that, you know, wants America to be great again. But that says that America being great and doesn't think about all those groups that Langston Hughes brilliantly listed as the speakers, as the voices in this particular poem, though it wasn't great for them at that time. And so, you know, I think that sense of nostalgia is implicit in every single time somebody critiques a Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah, I also want to say there is nothing nostalgic in the Langston Hughes poem. I mean, you're right that poem sits on one side of the spectrum, and on the other side for me is the slogan Make America Great Again. Langston Hughes is not hearkening back to some ideal of America that wasn't inclusive. I think he's saying in that poem, we had a shining ideal. It was an idea. Let us be that. Let us fulfill that original idea. And then the whole poem goes through all the ways we're not fulfilling that. That is not Make America Great Again, in my view.
No, not at all. And yeah, I mean, it was actually a pretty scathing critique right. of that America has never lived up to its ideals.
Right.
And but this is the part, and this is the cool part about the poem, is that he always reserved the right for that judgment to be changed. Okay, well, let's do it. It's still hopeful to me when it says that when it says that, you know, there's if we do these things, if we include these voices, if we actually contemplate the perspectives, the worldviews. You know, of so many, you know, that the dog eat dog of mighty crush the weak. If we contemplate these and start to have a bigger picture of what America ideals was supposed to be. And, you know, it was interesting. And it's also just the sign of the times. It's not written in 1935. You know, there was no mention of women in here. There was no mention of, you know, of many other communities that have since that time. Fortunately, been brought to the table as you know, having a very credible and valid place within these conversations. But, you know, he still reserved the right for it to be evolutionary. That, yeah, this is a scathing critique, yet America can be, because these ideals, this ideal, the dream that the dreamers dreamed was so strong. And it really was strong as a historical matter. And Thomas Jefferson, you know, during that time, slaveholder, we have all these critiques, and we should absolutely have those historical critiques. But, you know, he talked about a better day when there wouldn't be, you know, this dehumanization specifically of Black people in this nation. And, you know, so I appreciated that about Langston Hughes. Was it was biting. It was scathing. But it wasn't damning. It did not say that we're stuck never to be this.
You mentioned a minute ago your father and grandfather as veterans. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up and were you raised with extended family around you?
So I grew up, I'm a product of the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in Browning, Montana.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful Browning, Montana is one of the most incredible, beautiful places in the world. I moved to Washington State when I was 12 years old, almost 13. And I lived amongst several different Indian reservations here, the Nisqually Indian Reservation and then Suquamish Reservation, which is my other home. Both those places, I consider myself to be both from both places. My grandfather, every family has a certain amount of, it seemed like it was almost a requirement at a time that there would be civil service, that there would be a level of involvement in the military. And he played that role for his family in the Korean conflict and then later Vietnam. And then my dad was the exact opposite. My dad was, you know, it's 1960s, you know, hippie. he didn't want to be in Vietnam, but he still did his service. You know, he still went over there and he did a tour in Vietnam. And it was interesting because you asked about extended family. I'll get there very, very shortly. But on that side of my family, my father's side of the family, it was interesting generationally because my father and my grandfather have both since passed. But to see the generational divide in regards to service, you know, where at one hand, my grandfather, I'm also, in addition to being Blackfeet, I'm a quarter African-American. And my grandfather, who was African-American, you know, there just weren't a lot of opportunities vocationally. So the military was seen as a great out. Oh, you can actually do something. You can make a career out of this. You can get a retirement. You get a paycheck. And then my dad, this is the 60s, the roar, you know, and there's more opportunity. We can go to school. And then you fast forward to my particular generation where, you know, it seemed like there was economics aside because, you know, college is criminal the way the rates are right now. But my dad was like, no, you're just not going to do it. So a lot of that idealism seem to have slipped away regarding the military, regarding service, regarding our quote unquote debt to make sure that that's the way, you know, we honor ourselves as, you know, as being, you know, having service to the United States. And there's certainly a lot of folks who still feel that obligation and familial legacy. But, you know, it seems like it's a little bit different, even for those folks who do consider themselves, you know, to have that legacy of military service, in that it seems like we question it a little bit more, like, okay, well, let's see what our involvement is over in Iraq. Let's look at Afghanistan. Let's look at Syria. So there was an interesting progression of perspective on the military there. I have a huge family, and I'm fortunate to have grown up largely within Native communities where a lot of my family is just immediately around me. And, you know, so for example, on the Suquamish Reservation for a long time, I lived, you know, on one side of the street in a Native community, Native housing development. And then on the other side of the street is my sister, my adult sister with her children and husband. And then, you know, down the street from there is a cousin. And so I grew up in both places, on the Suquamish Reservation as well as the Blackfeet Reservation, with a lot of family around me.
You're listening to a new conversation in our series, What It Means to Be an American. I'm talking today with Jazzy Ross. He's an essayist, spoken word artist, and a poet, and a member of the Blackfeet Nation, and talking to us this morning about how some of these questions inform his perception of what it means to be an American. Here's something I want to ask you about, Jazzy. Where do you think the idea of American exceptionalism fits into this? And I wonder how your grandfather, your father, and now you would think about that in different ways.
American exceptionalism is behind all of these conversations. That's a great question. And the reason why I say that is because if we did not start with this document that said that all men are created equal, then okay, well, I guess we're not equal. I guess we have no standard to compare against and say we're not doing this right. My former life, I was a lawyer. And the first thing you do in any when you have a case, I did criminal law, was to actually look at the statute. You looked at the law and said, okay, well, this was the expectation, because the standard, you know, that the law makes the expectation. So the law that was created the expectation that all men are created equally. Obviously, it's still not inclusive of women, but nonetheless, it starts off with this very egalitarian statement that sounds like it's aspirational. Well, we're supposed to live up to this. And then immediately, it's evident that we're not living up to that. Well, black people are 3/5 of a person. And that was for representational purposes, so that the North didn't have an unwinnable majority. Native people were not people. Were not considered. The Doctrine of Discovery, Johnson v. McIntosh case. You said that Native people did not have the right to own this land, even though we've lived here for 30,000 years. And so they start having these asterisks on that statement, all men are created equally, except blah 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 blah, and so that gave us the backdrop by which to always critique this nation when we create these documents, whether it be the Declaration of Independence, which or alternatively the Constitution. If we're not living up to that, well then we're not as exceptional as we think. We still have the same baggage that any of these other nations, which we consider to be many things, whether it be third world or whether consider it to be a nation that treats women badly. We have a lot of these issues ourselves. And so it's always a consideration, in my estimation, that it gives us the very basis by which a poem like Let America Be America Again, or Colin Kaepernick kneeling for the national anthem, or any of the other myriad of critiques that we've seen throughout the years, that gives us the basis, the foundation to be able to do that.
One of the things that I've asked our guests for the series to consider is a speech that President Obama made in Selma earlier this year, in which he speaks to this idea of who we are and what we are and are we missing the mark. And I thought I would pull out a little excerpt here and ask you to listen to it and tell me what kinds of ideas this sparks. Let's listen.
It's the idea held by generations of citizens who believe that America is a constant work in progress, who believe that loving this country requires more than singing its praises or avoiding uncomfortable truths. It requires the occasional disruption, the willingness to speak out for what is right, to shake up the status quo. That's America.
We've talked a little bit about shaking up that status quo. What I also think is important in what he said there is the idea of a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
As work on ourselves, right? As we, the people, not we're building the economy to get, not those things that you can measure, more as a kind of consciousness around we, the people. I feel like we forget that too often. What does that say to you?
Well, our nation was built upon revolution, right? If it hadn't been for revolution, if it hadn't been for disruptors, if it hadn't been for interruptors, we wouldn't literally as an entity would not be here. And so that's constantly been the struggle is, I think we mentioned Thomas Jefferson just a second ago. And he had a statement that I try to contemplate every single time I write, every single time I speak, because I feel like we all have an obligation to be part of this evolutionary process that President Obama talked about. Thomas Jefferson said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." And if there is, in fact, a judgment, if there is in fact a God. I think we have an obligation to try to make the nation a more just place. And that doesn't come easily, especially when the folks who are creating the conversations, when the folks who are curating, and when I'm talking about, you know, big money interests, Citizens United, have a vested interest in quelling disruption. And so they, a lot of times that happens through economics. You know, we're going to determine who has, who's considered, you know, viable, and who has standing in order to have a voice within this nation. And I think what President Obama talked about, what Thomas Jefferson spoke about, what Colin Kaepernick is showing, what the all the folks, every single squeaky wheel that is willing to disrupt and interrupt, all of my folks on right now who are out in the prayer camps working against the Dakota Access Pipeline, who don't have any money, don't have any resources except for their ingenuity, their brilliance, all those Native people who are disrupting the normal discourse of business as usual, and who are being arrested every single day right now in real time and are in freezing cold conditions, but they're committed to making that judgment more just, to being part of that evolutionary process, even if it causes them personal discomfort. And so, you know, I'm so proud when I see people that are willing to take those stances that I couldn't even imagine, you know, that are so uncomfortable. We all know what it feels like to be in an uncomfortable conversation, and what it feels like to say something, and man, I really don't know how that's going to be taken. But to actually take that to the point where Colin Kaepernick is taking it, where he's getting booed, where he's getting death threats for something that he feels is valid and just, to take it to a point where those folks, once again, on Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, are fighting against the Dakota Access Pipeline, are physically discomforted. That's a powerful place. And I think that's exactly who is the alternate voice in Let America Be American Again. I think that was exactly what President Obama was talking about. I think that was exactly what Thomas Jefferson was talking about, that these people are ultimately going to be the steel that sharpens steel and makes America a better place, and hopefully brings back those aspirations.
You know, you sound surprisingly optimistic about this.
You know, I think we have to be. Number one, I think just as a practical matter, I have children, and I want, you know, I have to be. Otherwise, this is dismal. But number two, I think we can look at Donald Trump right now. And Donald Trump, you know, it's funny, I was in Canada the other day. But I think, you know, we look at Donald Trump and we look at the 40% of people who seem, no matter what he says, mm-hmm. when he said that he can shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue mm-hmm. and still win. I mean, it seems like he's very prophetic in that sense, that no matter what he does, no matter what he says, there's 40% of the population that's going to support him. And I think we look at that and might get dissuaded and say darkness, hate, separation, division are winning. But I also look that he's being called to the carpet in ways that I don't think any of us anticipated. You know, it's actually been, to me, positive. Part of that steel sharpening steel, when I look at, we're questioning assumptions that we've had for a long time. And I work within a lot of schools that are questioning assumptions that we've had for a long time. I'll tell this story a lot. But when I was a young boy, we used to play a game called Smear the Queer. And it was a football game. And it was a game in which, you know, people would throw the football up in the air and then you'd catch it and then you'd run until somebody, that you know, a group of people would dogpile you, tackle you viciously. Mm-hmm. And presumably you were the queer. And I, you know, my son, as little kids are wont to do, you know, he asked me brilliant questions. He says, why would anybody want to catch the ball? And I said, I don't know. I have no clue why. It's stupid. But and then he can't fathom the idea at 9 years old that we would play this game that has hurtful language in it.
Mm-hmm.
He's questioning that assumption. He's growing up with a different assumption. He's questioning the idea of why it would be weird. And we have open conversations about this, about the time when I grew up in. The assumptions that I did not question, because there's a lot of those. And I have to be honest that there was a lot of times where I was complicit in that trajectory of division and hate. You know, his uncles, he has two uncles who were the first two LGBTQ same-sex marriage in Washington state under tribal law, Suquamish tribal law, because Suquamish tribal law was more advanced. It was quicker to the process. And to recognize same-sex marriage than the rest of the state. And he has two uncles who are married. And we talk honestly about this. And I said, there was a time when people would not have been okay. And I tell him further, there's a time where your great-grandpa is from, where in Virginia, this is my black grandfather, where your great-grandfather was from, where people actually had to go to the Supreme Court to say that they're married, because it was a woman who was native and black marrying a white man. And people actually made a big deal about it, such a big deal that they went to the Supreme Court. And I said, we didn't question those assumptions. And now your generation, you kids don't care about any of this. You guys are, you know, it doesn't matter to you. It seems so intuitive to you to include. And so I see all of these things that people call political correctness. People call, being overly sensitive. It's beautiful. Thank God we're being sensitive. We have literally hundreds of years of insensitivity. We have a lot of sensitivity to make up for. And so I'm incredibly optimistic because I see a heightened sense of humanity amongst our children who are questioning assumptions. We look at these social movements that are starting, whether you're talking about Black Lives Matter, which has been incredibly powerful, to the No Dakota Access Pipeline movement, to Occupy, to all these movements were started by young people who were doing something that one generation ago would have been considered just political correctness gone amok, gone awry. It would have been considered overly sensitive, but they're creating conversations that we didn't have. We're coming out, in my estimation, we're coming out, Carrie, of a very, very primitive period. And there's beautiful things about primitivity. There's a lot of things I appreciate, but I think that we can say with almost consensus that it's good that we're questioning these assumptions, and that small yet vocal percentage of the population that love that primitivity and it wants to make America great again, but wants to make it great again in the most lowest common denominator terms. Those folks are going to go down swinging. They're going to go down fighting, and they're going to go down with ugliness and vile and vitriol. But that doesn't mean they're winning. It just means that they see the end is near.
Dear Native youth, I wrote this song for you, cause I wanted you to know that I put my heart into. I get inspired every time that I speak to you. I can acknowledge all the things that you're going through.
Is there a writer who expresses both the optimism that I just heard from you and maybe some of your your fears, your challenges for what it means to be an American, a poet or a fiction writer?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm definitely, I'm here in the studio in Seattle, Washington. And so as a Native writer, it's hard to get under the shadow of Sherman Alexie. He's an absolutely amazing writer. He's a brilliant commentator. And, I think that he expresses as a human being, you know, the insecurities, but yet the sense of optimism that I feel that we have to have. And it's powerful, you know, that, you know, for Native people, find Deloria, and I'm gonna you know, paraphrase badly, and I apologize for that, but brilliant Native scholar Vine Deloria talked about how for Native people, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, there were less than 250,000 of us. Almost there was less than 1,000 buffalo as a result of an intentional campaign to you know, kill the food sources of Native people, going from over 60 million to less than 1,000. And Native people had been subjected to boarding schools, forcefully stealing children. And he said, we've seen the worst. we've seen the worst, and we're still here. And somebody asked him, was he, you know, scared for the future? And he said, if anybody should be scared, it should be those folks who haven't seen the worst, because we've already been tried by fire. And that, to me, that's, it's so true that for many of us, for, you know, there is a, as Thomas Jefferson talked about, there will be a reckoning, and hopefully it's not bloody. Hopefully it's not, you know, it's not brutal or violent. When he says, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. There's different opinions about who he was talking about or what he was talking about. But I think he was talking about slavery. I think he was talking about the very, very structure, the foundation of this nation. When you say that all men are created equally, yet you do something that's so fundamentally unjust as declare people not to be human beings. Women were still chattel property. African Americans were 3/5 of a person. Native people just weren't recognized. His justice cannot sleep forever. And so, you know, I hope that reckoning is not violent. But if there's a group, and Thomas Jefferson is correct, that, you know, is feeling nervous, and we see this, it's white males. It's white males. It's men like Donald Trump. It's men who have always been on the right side of the privilege scale, who have always had their power and have always had the assumption that they're supposed to be in power. And, you know, and so those folks are seeing just a slight shakeup to, you know, when you saw the two sisters disrupt presidential candidate at that time, Bernie Sanders, on stage. It felt just viscerally like, man, we're seeing something we shouldn't see. But the truth is that we should have been seeing this. We should have been seeing this for a long time. But because the scales of power have been so badly skewed, we didn't see that for a long time. And we're going to see a whole bunch more of that in the future, of disruptions to white, powerful white men, their assumption of power. And so, you know, I think that, you know, some of the writers that are questioning those things, and you can look, Kaise Lehman, amazing writer. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
No.
He's from Mississippi, and he, I mean, there's so many disruptors, people who understand that we're coming out of an era and we're moving into another era, and it's scary. Because people don't recognize it, man. We've just been, you know, kind of assuming that these white guys are supposed to be in power for so long. We kind of got to figure this out, and we got to figure out how our positive platform, you know, what our platform actually is, how this new era is going to look. Are we just going to, you know, is David going to defeat Goliath simply to become Goliath? Hopefully not. Hopefully David is going to defeat Goliath in order to make a more equitable place where all voices and all conversations are created and have a place based upon the merit, the substantive merit of their voice. And so hopefully that's where we're moving into. And there's a lot of writers. I'll just mention Kaise and Sherman Alexie, but there's so many people who are inspiring me right now.
And Jossie, I know that you've read the words of John Mohawk, what the Seneca philosopher.
My hero.
Your hero. Tell me why.
Yeah. Well, first of all, he was connected to the earth in a way that I'm not. You know, and that's being 100% honest. Maybe too much. I'm too honest for radio.
Well, and let me say this. Mohawk said, right after people, earth, then it goes to grasses, waters, trees, plants, winds, the moon, the stars, the sun, the universe. And then he talked about the poetry of the reliance on those things. So when you say that he was connected to the earth in a way that you were not, I hear that in that quote.
He's incredible. And more important, like the reason why he was my hero personally was because John Mohawk was a functionalist. He understood that ultimately systems give way to other systems. And he has one of my most cited quotes of all time. He said that culture, and this is my commentary right here, you know, this thing that we, you know, people use the word culture very, very almost talisman-like. They don't necessarily say what it is, but they use it. But he said he reduced what culture is to a very, very useful thing. He said culture is a learned means of survival in an environment. And so that tells me, well, environments change. Environment shifts. And so cultures necessarily shift. The environment of the United States is shifting. And whether we want to or not, whether these folks who have this primitive viewpoint that all men are not created equally, that women aren't even in the conversation, that we should not consider our LGBTQ brothers and sisters, and you know, it doesn't matter. The culture is shifting. And the environment is shifting, excuse me. And so, you know, and it's shifting to that place where they those folks hate, where it is more sensitive, where people are being overly sensitive, where it is being what they would term politically correct. But just like a good basketball game, it doesn't matter if you're complaining about the referees. The referees are going to call what they're calling. And Donald Trump right now is being called out by a whole bunch of referees. because that culture is shifting. The environment is shifting. And so he, you know, and that's going to continue. That's going to get even more pronounced. This thing where we hold people accountable for their viewpoints when they say something that's racist or homophobic or sexist or misogynistic, it's going to continue to get more pronounced. And there will be some backlash for it. But John Mohawk, culture is a learned means of survival in an environment. In order to survive in this new environment, those folks are going to have to learn a new culture. They're just not going to be able to survive in a 2020 culture, a 2025 culture. It's going to be so much better because people are actually going to normalize. That's a very important word, are going to normalize an expectation of treating human beings as human beings. Came from Eastern Oklahoma in 41. We moved to California. We left our Oklahoma homes and Texas and Arkansas.
Programming is supported by the Guthrie Theater presenting The Parchment Hour, the songs and stories of the 1961 Freedom Riders, now through November 6th. Tickets and information at GuthrieTheater.org.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported in part by Target, committed to giving 5% of its profit to communities, more than $4 million every week. More information at Target.com/community.
Support comes from St. Jude Medical Foundation, the philanthropic arm of St. Jude Medical, a global medical device company headquartered in St. Paul, changing lives worldwide through grants and volunteerism for education, patient support, and healthy communities. SJM.com.
Good morning. I'm Tom Weber on NPR News. If you're wondering about the music that you just heard during Carrie's interview with author and speaker Jossie Ross, they were chosen by Jossie, and they include the songs Chief Don't Run by Jadena, a Mike Jordan song called Dear Native Youth. There's a hashtag right in front of Dear Native Youth. and John Paul Hodge with a song called Bakersfield Drawl. You can find those songs wherever you get your music.